First of all, I thank the organizing committee for inviting me to this great conference. And I hope that you can stay awake for another hour because it is a long day. So today, I'm going to talk about minority languages in Indonesia in relation to the questions of language management. That is deliberate control of language used to get certain intended outcomes. What I'm going to talk about is a complex interplay between issues and responses at the macro national level and the most local level, the micro level, on the basis of my experiences working on languages in Flores and also in West Papua recently. This is the outline of the talk, so it's divided into three. First of all, I'll set out the setting of the context and then move on to strategic issues in talking about the politics of language in Indonesia. And then part three, I'll talk about my own experiences, kind of comparing the situations in Flores, particularly this language Rongga that I work on, and recently I expand my research on Marori in West Papua. Part one, for those who don't know Indonesia, this is Indonesia. Okay. This is Bali, my home island. And this is Flores. Rongga language is spoken in central western Flores. And this is West Papua, Indonesian Papua. Working on a language called Marori, 15 kilometers east of Merauke. And this is Sabang. So the reason that I put Sabang and Merauke in this map, Sabang and Merauke, Sabang is the westernmost town and Merauke is the easternmost town in Indonesia. These two towns, even though they are small towns, they are strategically very important towns as far as Indonesian territorial integrity is concerned. So this is very relevant for the discussion later on. I'll put it there. And also, I'll show later on kind of, you know, one of the songs that students from early on schools must sing from the primary school, even from kindergarten. Indonesia, as you know, it's ethnically, culturally, and linguistically very diverse. It is home to over 500 languages. Roughly 10% of the languages in the world. This makes Indonesia quite diverse. Because of the size of the country and the diversity of the country, and we know that from the independence in 1945, we spend most of the time fighting with each other because of diversity. So the notion of diversity is very important, and then that's why the motto, Bhinneka Tunggal Ika, unity and diversity, is something that is important and promoted and enforced from the beginning at schools. And this is originally kind of, you know, promoted by the government, but as we see, also kind of also now supported, for example, by private companies, you know, advertisement on TV. So I just want to show the advertisement on TV. You have different backgrounds, diversity in terms of the people who sing the song, and also the background of the places, landmarks. But the quality of the video is a bit dodgy. But anyway, the point is there. Have a look. This is the Sabang and Merauke. Hopefully it's going on.
Dari Sabang sampai Merauke. Pulau-pulau. Sambung menyambung.
look at the subtitle. Okay, this is more than advertisement, right? This is a Telkomsel, but the whole thing is the lagu Dari Sabang Sampai Merauke. From Sabang to Merauke, it's more than simply advertisement for Telkomsel, but it's more, it's kind of part of nation building. So this is something that very important to know. And another thing, this is just historical context. Indonesia declared its independence in 1945, but for the discussion now in terms of language maintenance in Indonesia, one of the figures that is relevant is Suharto. The president, this one, he was the president and managed to impose a kind of highly centralized government. But then when the Indonesian the economy, economic crisis swept through Southeast Asia, and then he was forced to step down. And then since then, we have four presidents. And then Indonesia has embarked to a new kind of, you know, shifted to a very democratic system nowadays. But I argue that even though there has been radical shift in the current reformation era, national unity is still a top priority. And the politics of language and related strategic issues in relation to language management in Indonesia is still kind of basically the same. It's part of nation building, and Indonesianization is there still. And as you know, diversity has two kind of sides. The negative side is, you know, you have disunity. But on the other hand, the government promoting the idea of diversity that is to be celebrated. And we already see the Telkomsel kind of advertisement. But you may think that because Telkomsel owned by the government and is in the government interest. But the next video is Indomie. What is interesting about Indomie? Indomie is the instant noodle, Indonesian noodle. We like Indonesian noodle, in, even in Australia, you know, family like that. And even across regions to Merauke and people, Papuan people like instant noodle as well, the Indomie. So what's interesting about Indomie, you have the same advertisement, but most of the, you know, 1 minute duration, it's about nation building. You have lyrics with different languages. You have Papuan, Malay, Balinese, Javanese, and of course Indonesian, and ended up with kind of, you know, one taste for all. One taste for all. Let's see. I like the melody. Not only Inumi. Okay, it's very, you know, subtle advertisement. you have different languages, different lyrics, encoding, kind of express, you know, promoting diversity languages, you know, different languages. You have different people singing the song, but ended up it's satu selera untuk semua, one taste for all, one language, one nation. You know, it's kind of very subtle kind of advertisement, more than simply Indomie advertisement, right? So, okay. Another point that I want to show here is that nation building done throughout the advertisement by the government, supported by private companies. Another thing to note about Indonesia is that the transmigration. This is a strategic program by the government to encourage, originally encourage people moving from Java to other islands. Including West Papua, Indonesian Papua, and recently there are, you know, people kind of spontaneous transmigration, it's called it. People can self-funded, you know, they go there, you know, with their own kind of money and go eagerly there, kind of because the opportunities are there. So this is a picture taken from field work as a site in. Kampung Wasur in Merauke. This is a Japanese guy, a vendor, selling different sort of vegetable, daily staples going around in Kampung Wasur where Marori is spoken now. This is not the only guy. There are other Japanese around, but this guy only recently kind of migrated to Merauke around there. There are also people from Java who went there earlier, you know, now they're second generation. They originally kind of placed at the interior part of Papua, but then the second generation and then moved to the suburban area, to the Kampung Wasur. So the point that I want to show here is even a kampung at, you know, close to the border to PNG side, now the Indonesian border, it's already a multi kind of ethnic kampung. You have not only the Marori local Papuan people, but also people from Java, from other parts of Indonesia, including South Sulawesi, Southeast Maluku. Now just some statistics as a background. In Indonesia, you have two main groups of languages. You have Austronesian and non-Austronesians around 550. If you put it in the graph, so you have more Austronesian languages, around 40%. And if you consider languages having speakers fewer than 1,000 as minority languages, minority in their own regions, then you have around 34% of the languages are considered a minority. Now, when we talk about minority languages in Indonesia and talk about the concern of language shift or language loss, we also have to talk about language ecology and language contact. And of course, we are going to talk about language management. And I find the ecological metaphor enlightening, and therefore use it to conceptualize the complex dynamics of variables involved in the survival of minority languages in Indonesia. So this is the language ecology in Indonesia that I can show here. It consists of the two spheres here. The top one is the sociolinguistics spheres, and the non-linguistics one at the bottom one here. The double arrow means the interaction in both direction, and the up arrow here means the causal relations. What you have here in the sociolinguistics environment, let's say here, you have polyglossic multilingual situations, where standard Indonesian is at the top, most prestigious variety and something that people should learn through education and aim at. And I don't think that, well, people kind of trying to aim at this one, but then, it should be acquired through education. And at the bottom, you have minority languages. In between, you have regional languages, like, for example, in Flores, you have Manggarai, or in Kupang, you have perhaps the local Kupang Malay there, and also other colloquial Indonesian, for example, Jakartan Indonesian. So it's kind of complex polyglossic situation and unstable multilingualism with respect to minority languages. And the non-linguistics spheres here, we have a number of variables, including sociocultural, historical, politics, geographical, and economic. I'll talk about it, about this later on, when we talk about the comparative studies between Rongga and Marori. Okay, I've just given you the just the setting, the sociolinguistic setting is language ecology. And now we move on to the strategic issues and the politics of language in Indonesia. So the questions are, what are the strategic issues regarding minority languages in Indonesia, and how do we make sense of the things that's going on in Indonesia currently? So the way to see the issues here is to look at the, as I said, the micro national level and the micro regional and local level, and the complex interplay between the two perspectives, which are embedded within a complex socio-political environment, that is the language ecology that I just mentioned. And I want to show that much of the dynamics of the politics of language in Indonesia is explainable in terms of salient categories, ancaman, threat, and peluang, and also within this Binika Tunggalika kind of, you know, motto, part of embedded within the national ideology of Pancasila, five principles. And what is important here is, if you look at these issues, the categories of the issues in terms of the threat and opportunities and central, pusat, and the regional, local. There is one point that I want to show it on is the, talk about this from the cognitive point of view, is the filter, individual and organizational filters at all levels. That it, you know, play roles in kind of the complex interplay. In particular, if you want to talk about the situation at the most local level on the basis of my experience, the particular filter that I'm interested in is the adat filter. So, since maintaining a language is about human actions and all behaviors in relation to organized groups, speech communities, and also modern states, institutions, I find the insights from organization theory kind of very useful. So the first relevant point here is the finding from studies in decision-making. That is, different stimuli evoke different decision processes, and categories of threat and opportunity are relevant and consequential for decision processes and also the responses given. And another point is the category labeling. If you look at the interaction of the national kind of perspective, what Jakarta wanted to label you as, for example, a separatist or something, that kind of label associated with threat. So we see later on the importance of category labeling and the interpretive meaning from the perspective of categorization theory. The notion of prototype is important here. So applying it to language management means applying it to social objects, which are very fuzzy, even fuzzier than natural objects. Categorization theory provides us with a framework, a way of conceptualizing how issues are labeled and consequently processed and responded. So what I have here very briefly is the general process model, how cognitive processes affect behavior. This is on the basis of studies like this. This general process provides a framework of a linkage between identification or processing of strategic categories and the responses. So within this model, individuals and organizations, including the local community, are placed within an environment consisting of a set of events, trends, and developments. Individuals or organizations, including the local community, are bombarded with a range of information coming from the environment. But not all of the issues are perceived. Okay, they are selectively perceived. This is based. This is because of the limitation. There is information capacity limits, and also importantly, because of the filters. Okay, so not issues are perceived, but perceived depending on the filters of the organization. And once the issues penetrate these filters, then given the label, and then further processed and given. Appropriate responses. So this is a kind of framework, a model by which you can see how, for example, Jakarta, the same issues, for example, a demonstration in West Papua and Jayapura and Denpasar, for example, regarding the same kind of issue, but then differently processed by Jakarta because of different filters depending on the organization here. So I'm going to use this kind of model to understand what's going on in Indonesia and exemplify the cases from the cases in Flores and West Papua. So on the basis of sociopolitical context in Indonesia as we understand it now, I propose a macro level categories, something like this. So at the most at the top macro level, you have the category pusat and daerah, which is central and very important, which is based on the notion of Bhinneka Tunggal Ika, national associated with national unity, part of the national ideology. This is part of the territorial categories. And then you have different sort of categories. As I said, you have ancaman and peluang and issues in terms of language are embedded within this kind of, complex categories. And we see later on that at the most local level, these categories are still relevant, but then also filtered out by the adat, the custom kind of, values by which, for example, the idea of respect, trust are relevant. But then we have later on kind of complex interaction and a clash between the perspective of the national kind of interest and the local interest. We see later on from the examples cases. So of particular interest, I already talked about the unity in diversity, which is originally initiated by the government, but then kind of promoted by business private sectors because of their own interest. They have their own interest for the stability of Indonesia because of economic opportunities. But government has their own kind of interest as well. And then I also already talked about self-sponsored business migrants to West Papua, for example, kind of squeezing the local communities, including their languages, and kind of shifting the demographic composition. And we know now, for example, this is in Kampung Wasur, where I did my I have been doing my fieldwork. You have the people talking Japanese, Indonesian, and of course also other languages like from Kei. And then the Marori is no longer spoken even within that kampung. Okay. And then another thing that I want to highlight as part of this complex, from macro perspective, government kind of interest and also part of the nation building is the Bahasa Persatuan, unifying language. Indonesian is perceived as having symbolic and instrumental values to tie the archipelago together as one nation. And I think, I'm not sure whether any other country in the world has a special status attached to the national language. Bahasa Indonesia has the status as a national language, but it also has a status as a unifying language. It's stated now in the current law. But then the idea of Bahasa Persatuan actually strategically decided long before Indonesia got the independence, that is in 1928, when the youth organization had the Congress and decided to choose the Malay, pick up Malay as Bahasa Indonesia, rename it Bahasa Indonesia. It's a strategic decision because at the time Malay was already lingua franca, and also importantly, the dominant group Javanese were okay with that because you know, and also because Javanese, you know, it's complex speech level. Don't think that people would learn, you know, Javanese, and it's not as, and Malay is not associated with any particular dominant group. So the even now within, as I said, Indonesia has moved shifted to a very democratic system now. We call the Reformation era, but Bahasa Persatuan still debated recently in Jakarta. In one of the government-sponsored seminar, still debated, and then it seems. Well, the academics and people know that the negative impact of Bahasa Indonesia is Bahasa Persatuan, not only Bahasa Persatuan, but any other label in imposing kind of, you know, the language policy, basically. But the government insisted on a kind of this again and not something that the participant kind of fed up with this. And then this is the comment of one of the participants there. Tidak usah dirisaukan bahasa Indonesia sebagai bahasa persatuan karena hal itu sudah tercapai. Yang perlu diperhatikan adalah bahasa, pengajaran bahasa daerah. We should no longer be concerned with Indonesia, Indonesian as a unifying language. Well, sort of, because this has been achieved. But then what is important for the academics in Indonesia now, we talk about the teaching of local languages, but again, this is the from the government perspective, Bahasa Persatuan is still something that is needed to be part of the law and passed as part of the laws recently. Another thing that of particular interest is Pusat Bahasa. Pusat Bahasa is, or National Language Center, is a special government body set up in 1975 to manage language issues, national language policy, and also dealing with local languages. What I did is just, you know, to see what I did, kind of a small study to look at the publications of Pusat Bahasa as an indication of the issues and priorities, because this is the government institution, and I look at the number of their publications. Forget about the quality, but just the publication, just indication of the interest and priorities. It turns out that from the period of over 32 years, they produce around 15 or more than 1,500 publications. And if you look at the statistics here, Indonesian 36% and local Malay 34% and funiculars only 30%. If you collapse the two categories, and then you have the bias, and this is something you know expected. Perhaps you know sport has been given to Indonesian and Malay rather than funicular. Even though the life of the local language is kind of guaranteed by the constitution. And also, if you look at the vernacular languages, look at the publication, and it turns out that the publications associated with the Javanese, okay, and also Sundanese, the two languages, you know, majority languages, and also Balinese, it turns out, okay, and only kind of small kind of attention given to other languages. Also, in terms of regions, what you see here are languages in western part of Indonesia kind of given more attention rather than languages of eastern Indonesia. So I mean this because you know 1/3 of the languages in Indonesia kind of located here. But then if you look at the statistics, this shows the kind of bias in terms of retention. Okay. So the points I think I just want to show there are two points. First is the the issues, strategic issues in Indonesia kind of still revolve around nation building, and also kind of. A part of the government's, well, it's not related to language, but for example, with the transmigration, moving people around, just, to part of nation building, but then that would have and also has had impact on local languages. And also another thing that I had just, I saw here, if you look at the policies and also what Pusat Bahasa is one of the government's institutions responsible for language policy. There's a bias towards Bahasa Indonesia and also majority languages. Okay, now, part three, I just want to look at the situation in Flores and Papua. So again, this is Ronga and Marori. Ronga is an Austronesian language spoken by around 4,000 people in west central kind of western Flores, and Marori is a Papuan language spoken by now you have Marori people around 100 people, but fluent speakers around 15 or so, very endangered. Now, if you look at the range of the variables in the handouts, you see the prognosis is not promising if you look at the range of variables, for example, in terms of the sociolinguistics, the domains of the language, the languages, they're just the same, very limited and declining. In terms of the status, when I talk about the diagnostic situation, both Ronga and Marori, they're just at the bottom hierarchy. As I said, Ronga in Flores still spoken in the village, but Marori, as I said, the Kampung Wasur, where Marori is spoken, now you have Javanese, second generation of Javanese moving in from the transmigration sites in the interior part of Papua. They move to the suburban area of Merauke because the Kampung Wasur is located 15 kilometers away from the center town of Merauke. And also you have people not only from second generation of Javanese, but also other people from Sulawesi and Maluku kind of going there and living in the village. In terms of the domination, and both languages suffered from kind of a history of domination, Ronga in Flores, they are kind of dominated by Manggarayan, and the people, Marori people, kind of dominated by the Marin people. You might know that Marin people are, head hunting people. Most of Marori people kind of got killed earlier. you have a situation quite negative in a lot of variables there. In terms of the political contemporary Indonesian context here, you see they are too small to be able to kind of gain control even at the local level, right? And also, other variables are not promising either. And we'll, I don't want to go through this, but what I want to talk about now is on the basis of my field experiences, the issues that I found in the field, I classify them into four categories. That is to say, if you go to the field as a linguist, as, you know, in my situation, go to the field and doing, you have your own goal, kind of doing syntax, whatever, you know, kind of very theoretical, but when you meet people, then you meet people with their real need, and you have, you know, you do kind of a lot of non-linguistic things, and the issues, certainly we linguists can help in terms of the categories here, certainly in A, that is the content issues, providing kind of language descriptions, and perhaps helping with these resources for language programs. But talking about language maintenance or kind of, for example, later on, if you want to encourage the locals to do more on language documentation or doing something useful to maintain their language, then you talk about participation issues. That is encouraging, ensuring that, for example, the family is using the language in the family. And also, support issues, the same perhaps is true across Indonesia, but the same is true in Flores and in West Papua. So we linguists go there to the field. We may help, you know, while we still have funding, but then we need to provide a long-term support, talking to people, not only local people, but also local government, and perhaps also the government in Jakarta. And also another thing is the capacity building leadership issues. You know, my experience in the field as recruiting and training local leaders or local community members that you can work with, you know, and then when you leave, then something's going on, even though you are not in the field. I'll talk more about this in a moment. So the point that I want to talk first is the support issues, and then extend this to participation and capacity building issues within the current trend in Indonesia, especially the regional autonomy and also spatial autonomy. Remember that in 1998, when the crisis, the economic crisis swept through Southeast Asia, Suharto kind of was forced to step down, and this dramatic change towards democracy. Now we have direct election at different levels, you know, in Indonesia. And still, you have, as I said, the in terms of the language policy, still kind of, you know, basically the same. You still have the nation building, part of nation building is still there. But what I want to focus here is the, remember the pusat, central, and daerah, the tension between the Jakarta and the local within this current rapid change in democracy in Indonesia. So in 1998, Suharto was forced to step down, and at the time, the story, you know, East Timor kind of got the independence, and learning from the East Timor experience, two provinces, Aceh and West Papua, kind of, you know, were granted special autonomy by Jakarta because, you know, I think, whereas the West Papua is given special autonomy, but other provinces are just given ordinary autonomy. Why is that special? Because you have the idea of the pusat daerah tension and the idea of unity, and Jakarta does didn't want West Papua to follow suit with East Timor to be independent. So, in a way, West Papuan people collectively managed to play this threat and opportunity cards to you know, at the same time. And indeed, this is actually the case with this Rumbia. This is the Rumbia is one of the architects of the special autonomy in West Papua, and see how the meaning of this special autonomy is given. That is a strategy to strengthen the unity. So thinking of the unity to please Jakarta at one point, and then as an opportunity as well to, you know, to build West Papua, to get rid of blah, blah, blah here, backward knees or whatever it is. But anyway, they're playing around with, you know, the tension, you know, Jakarta thing of the, you know, the threat category, and thinking of national unity, and then the people collectively at the local, at regional level collectively, West Papuan people managed to play both cards together and force Jakarta to grant special autonomy, whereas other places just, you know, ordinary autonomy. Okay, so what this means in terms of, we just connect this in terms of language maintenance, is that, first of all, what special autonomy means is very important, and people sometimes don't know what special kehususan, special autonomy khusus, otsus, yeah, in Indonesian, is keunikan, kehususan, in terms of local governance, and also where adat elders. This is important, you know. In terms of kehususan, uniqueness of the autonomy, local adat elders may have representative. But this is still debated now. You have every single day demonstration in Jayapura. They want to give the special autonomy back to Jakarta. You know, now you know, given it back, and they just want to be independent, basically. And then another thing is, a part of the special autonomy is the funds, the funding that is coming with, that comes with special autonomy, that can be used to a variety of purposes, including language or culture. Okay, it's a lot of money. So this is. My experience in West Papua is that, you know, the local government officials, they have a lot of money from Jakarta. Suddenly, you know, you have corruption spreading down there, not only to West Papua, but also to other parts of Indonesia, but even worse in West Papua. So this is in Kampung Wasur. What you have there in Kampung Wasur with the Otsus money, the special autonomy money, is now the, I was there in last November, and then I attended, got invited to attend a community meeting, and they talk about what are we going to do with the money coming, a lot of money coming up. So 100 million rupiah. And then this one is the house built by Otsus money, the special autonomy money. As you know, we have houses free in a given. And then, interestingly, this is the public bathrooms. Even in Bali, you don't have public bathroom or toilet in the village. And, you know, it's interesting. So you have a lot of money. But again, the problem is you have a lot of money, how do you use the money? And, you know, language is not part of the discussion. This is interesting. Language is not part of the discussion, even though the local people know, and I talk to the elders in Kampung Marori about, you know, well, I was not an invited guest anyway, but they talk, they invite me into the meeting, but being in the village was not invited, but in the meeting was invited. But then again, they know that my presence there is part of, you know, I talk about language documentation, language maintenance, I mean, the danger, language in German, blah, 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 but they understand the elders. But when they talk about the money from the government, the language is not part of discussion. It's interesting. So this is the OTSUS money. You have the, potentially you have the resources there in West Papua. So again, I just want to show, now comparing the situation in West Papua, in Merauke and Rongga. So what you have in Rongga, the Rongga language, Flores is part of Nusa Tenggara Timur province, East Nusa Tenggara province. And NTT, the East Nusantara province, is one of the poorest province in Indonesia. But the problem is that, you know, people in Nusa Tenggara Timur, they don't have these cards, the threat and opportunity card to play with. Okay, even though they have demonstration in Kupang or Manggarai in Flores, Jakarta wouldn't see that way, and wouldn't, you know, consider that as a threat, and there's no. People in local minority in West Papua, they have a better positions in terms of resources compared to the minority groups in other part of Indonesia. I'm talking about Rongga only, but you know, other parts, minority groups in other part of Indonesia, they don't have the opportunity to have the money coming a lot from the government. But there is one potential side of this kind of tension and also the special autonomy. Remember that, you know, collectively the West Papuan people can play the opportunity and threat card against Jakarta collectively. But at the local level, so we have different levels talking about this category tension at different levels. At the local level, regional level, I mean, you know, in West Papuan province, you have the tension between provincial level, Jayapura, and the regional, for example, Merauke. There has been complaint from the money coming to the provincial level, but then there is a tension and the money just stay at Jayapura, not coming down to Merauke. So this is tension there. And even at Merauke, then you have domination of the, for example, Marine is the dominant ethnic group in Merauke. And what happened is that minority group like Maori, whose number is very small. So, for example, they don't have any kind of power, or they just, you know, accept the idea of the domination by the more dominant group. So, for example, this is the Balai Budaya in Kampung Wasur. Kampung Wasur is the kampung of Maori people. And this is the building, the cultural center is in that kampung. But the, you know, this is the name, Bomishai is Marine. This is the language of the dominant group. Okay, so this is even though the Maori people don't like it, but they don't have any choice. But you know, they want to change it. But well, you know, dominated by Marine people, who kind of, you know, dominate the local Kabupaten government in Merauke. And this one is the even the motto of the Merauke government here. You have Isakot Bekai, Isakot Kai. This is the local Marine words. And this is, interestingly, one point here is you have the local version of the unity and diversity. Something that I want to point out here is the cultural policy, language policies embedded within cultural policy of Indonesia, is that kebudayaan nasional, the national culture, is the peaks, the puncak-puncak of the local cultures. And then bahasa nasional, bahasa daerah, the local language, is pendukung, supporting the Bahasa Nasional. It means that you have the national language and Bahasa Indonesia or national culture, and you have local language supporting or local culture supporting that, and you have a parallel kind of things, and you have this kind of Bhinneka Tunggal Ika at the national level, and then the people from the local other areas finding out the equivalent in the locals' language, and this is what you have. And also, in other parts, if you see regional laws, peraturan daerah, for example, this is in Bali, you have part of the regional laws, local laws, you have the Indonesian place name, you have the Indonesian, and then you have the script. Balinese has script, but Marine doesn't. So, but in Balinese, you have this one. So you have the plates, government plates with both Indonesian and Balinese, and this is another one. Okay, now I move on to participation issues. My experience is that local participation and leadership are the hardest issues to address and to cultivate because at the most local level, because this entail internal motivation of the community members as individual and as a group, directly linked to collective strategic critical forward-looking assessment of environments. So it's really hard. I think there is no clear way, an easy way to shape and produce people with the right qualities at the local level to move forward if we talk about moving forward here, but at the most local level, it's very hard to see how, to get that, because such qualities can be only achieved, I think, among other things, via long-term, via education. It's a long-term investment process. Another thing, also, the issue of a class, as I mentioned, a class of the perspective, a priority. From the macro perspective, the government kind of concerned with the national unity, but the people at the local level, for example, in Marori, and not only Marori, but other Papuan people, they're concerned with their own physical survival, because the forest is, it's no longer there. I mean, they don't have a place to go for hunting, and this is real concerns. And also, now if you talk about language issues, cultural issues, or maintenance, this is kind of, not a priority. But then, again, if you talk about this kind of thing, talk about motivation, internal motivation, and my experience is that talking to elders, much easier to trigger the cognitive filters of the elders, kind of, well, yeah, this is important, this is the time that we have to preserve our language while we can speak it, But the younger generation is harder to tip to the that cognitive filter. So as an outsider, kind of going to the field, meaning, understanding this cognitive filter, in particular the adapt filters, okay? Once you can, understand that, then perhaps you can have a better understanding and also kind of, how to work together and kind of motivate local people to join the thing that you want them to do. Back to the idea of cognitive filters and in particular the adult filters, and what we can do as a linguist when we go to the field, and this is my experience, as I said, even though I'm interested in kind of, syntactic, thing to test, but then when, in the field, and in order to collaborate and work together with the locals, and you have to know the local situation. And so, for example, part of the ELDP project that I had, you kind of, having the awareness of language endangerment, we have to talk to the people. And this is, what the things that I did in Flores. This is one is, adopted as a son in the family, and basically, and then ritual, and then talking to local people, joining Gotong Royong, kind of community work, and then, usually docent, the university lecturer is very respected, and then you know people listen to you. Okay, you know, you pretend to know a lot, but but anyway, again, and then working with these Catholic priests, and also working with the local SD schools, elementary schools there, and also working with youth organization there. Working with the elders, kind of, for example, in this one, practicing and performing Vera, kind of organizing. Vera is endangered songs and dance, and you work with the, I work with this local teacher and how we train the students from the local schools and performing at the 17 Agustus, the celebration of the Independence Day, and then recorded and then kind of play it in DVD. And also at the national level, kind of having workshop training, and this is a workshop in Bali, national workshop with Margaret Flory and Nicholas Himmelman. I joined them. We train young linguists in Indonesia, kind of doing language documentation. And recently in West Papua, December, last year, I had a dictionary workshop with groups of people representing languages in around Merauke. So this is something that, you know, again, we linguists go to the field, we have our own agenda, but then it must be packaged. If you want to have positive collaboration and kind of meaningful interaction and kind of building the groundwork for long-term collaboration, I guess. Something that you have to do is you also kind of knowing what they need. So when after consulting what they need, they kind of interested in having, you know, starting a dictionary project. That's why, and then I got a small grant from the ANU, and we had a dictionary workshop. Okay. So I talk. I just talk about negative things about, you know, Indonesian kind of central government sending people to West Papua, kind of, you know, kind of from outside perspective. Oh, this is not good, and people kind of usually have negative kind of perception in terms of the mobility of people or the government policy to move people around. But there is a positive development as well. If you look at the people. In Merauke, if remember that I talk about the Japanese vendor going around and with you know, with this thing, and then thinking about this cognitive process model, you have people, individual bombarded with situation issues and a fast changing situation even in West Flores now. Okay, Indonesia is booming, and people go to West Flores from Java in a kind of a fast-changing environment. And it turns out that the arrival of Javanese with this kind of innovative kind of, you know, entrepreneurship, you know, then trigger, for example, local Papuan. I have Pak Dominikus, my kind of one of my language consultants. He set up an orchard farm. He went to the forest, and this is his orchard farm in Kampung Wasur, and he is quite, you know, and then the buyers coming not only from local Merauke, but people from Java, they kind of exporting to Java as well. So, and also the kiosk, for example, the local people joined that kind of, you know, new opportunities. So this is, again, you have people coming in, the world is fast changing, and the community, the local people, in one way or another have to react. And one certain things, the opportunities, kind of the categories, whatever you want to call them, penetrate the cognitive filter, they react and in a positive way. Okay, so the question, I guess, how does that kind of, you know, situation can be extended to include language kind of related, you know, issues. But this is the challenge, it's a hard thing, okay? Almost 1 hour, I kind of concluding now. This is the road going this is the orchard farm. The orchard farm is located here, and this is the trans Papua road going to the border to the PNG. So it's a kind of nice road. So, conclusion. I've talked about my experiences and kind of framing, making sense of what's going on in Indonesia and Flores and West Papua, and I talk about the threat and opportunity cards played by Papuan people, but you know, the Flores people and including Ronga people don't have that card, and just you know. But in a way, the minority groups in West Papua have better position if they can use the resources, the money quite wisely. Then it's possible that you know you have good kind of you know language programs later on. But yeah, and this is the conclusions. So the strategic issues in relation to minority languages and the politics of language in Indonesia haven't been changed, basically, in contemporary Indonesia, even though now you have, you know, very democratic country. But, for example, issues of Bahasa Indonesia, unifying language is still, you know, part of the discourse. And also the laws passed by the government recently still putting in the Bahasa Persatuan. And if you look at what's going on with Pusat Bahasa, the government body that looking after the language policies and also local languages, you see even now, you know, the situation hasn't changed. Even now, because of the regional autonomy and special autonomy, the responsibility of local languages is handed over to the local government. Okay, in the past, when the central government, when the Pusat Bahasa had the responsibility, they didn't do much, but now it's handed over to local government, but then at the local government, there's no guarantee. Well, there is no guarantee, but let's see. For example, in West Papua, last year, they had a national seminar, kind of, you know, perhaps funded by Otsus money. and then they talk about, you know, language maintenance, producing local materials. But again, it's still a kind of academic exercise like what we are doing here, rather than kind of helping local. And you know, it's more academic exercise rather than real kind of, you know, groundwork. So certain regions, as I said, West Papua have managed to manipulate the threat and opportunity cards at the macro level to force Jakarta to address their concerns. And potentially, this is very good for language maintenance in future. And the situation of tiny minority languages, such as Maori, is expected to remain unchanged, or at least there would not be any radical change towards a sudden outpouring of resources for its maintenance or revival in the near future. It's too small and too weak, and even its own region. And the road ahead is not going to be easy and will remain a challenge for all of us. The linkage between individual and collective internal motivation, the motivation of the local, to take challenge and ability to respond strategically is very difficult to create at the most local level. Motivation is a complex cognitive process which involves local adapt filters, for example, and this is particularly important. It's not always controllable by or accessible by outsiders. So even though I'm an Indonesian, I couldn't kind of, you know, access that kind of filters, and there are filters at the local level that we can't, you know, penetrate. But once you can, you know, the challenge is how then this local adat filters be penetrated by the relevant language issues. That's a challenge, I guess. So, back to this, the theme of this conference, the way to move forward. It seems to me that the notion of cognitive filters at the local level, how you understand the adapt filters, for example, how the motivation can be kind of created at the most local level, hasn't been well addressed, and that would be perhaps one of the things that needs to be addressed in language revival or language maintenance program. So I want to end this with the Indomie. I like the Indomie, so just add this one. That would be good. We just enjoy that one. Okay. Thank you. Any comments or questions? The full paper is already finished, still in draft. I'll put in my web page, and then if you have comments, hopefully later on you can.
Sessions. So what was the prime motivator of the volunteers for those projects?